When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
For has it not been written, we are safe from any threat, as long as those three golden balls are on the minaret?
Hey everyone, welcome back to Underrated. This is a podcast where we discuss the films that are underrated, underappreciated, and the ones that have slipped under the radar and passed most people by. I'm Derek McDuff, and I'm joined, as always, by Alan Torres.
Hey, everybody, how's it going?
And Ariel Ortiz.
Hello.
So every once in a while, we're going to start discussing a film that has been suggested to us by listeners. And this suggestion comes from our live show, and that is The Thief and the Cobbler. This film was a labor of love from the legendary animator Richard Williams, who spent more than three decades working on the film. Over the years, hundreds of animators worked on the film, which went in and out of production multiple times as Williams searched for funding. Finally, after his work as the animation director on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Williams was able to secure funding to finish the film. However, after going over budget and over schedule, the film was taken away from Williams to be finished by the Completion Bond Company quickly and cheaply. As a result, the film was drastically cut down, with the tone majorly changed to make it more in line with the popular Disney animated musicals of the time, and it was also released as The Princess and the Cobbler, initially overseas. Eventually, Miramax released a cut of the film in the US, retitled Arabian Night, with almost all of the voice cast aside from Vincent Price replaced, including both of the titular silent main characters being dubbed over. After years of restoration attempts on Williams' original work print by the likes of Roy E. Disney, a fan restoration known as the Recobbled Cut used storyboards to stitch together a complete version of Williams' original film in full. So with that all said, what did you guys think of the film, and what's your history with it?
My history is this is a movie of my childhood, the Miramax version specifically, so I have a very soft spot for that version. I'm more attuned with that style anyway, and a fan of that style anyway. There are moments like watching the Recobbled version where I could see like, oh yeah, maybe like that moment, you know, should have been kept in and stuff like that, but it was very interesting to watch the Recobbled scene this time around. And then I did like a quick rewatch of the Miramax, the one of my childhood as well. I think in theaters it was Arabian Nights, but once it got onto home video, it was changed back to
They did retitle it. It was kind of had a silent release, and it was eventually like in some cereal boxes and stuff as Thief and the Cobbler. So yeah, it's had a lot of different titles,
which was a very thing. They did that for Bambi, they did that for a lot of different Disney movies as well. That's the thing. I did also watch that documentary. And that's one of the moments where I was like, well, that wasn't as bad of a thing in the late
for a
90s.
Movie that was that recent, though. It was kind of like, because Bambi is like classic, you know.
No. They did it for like Lilo and Stitch, or not Lilo and Stitch, but early late 90s movies. Like, speaking of Lion King, they did it for Lion King as well. And it was very much just a thing of the time. But I'll digress on that. Definitely.
Yeah, I was just saying, a lot of re-releases.
Yeah, watching the Recobbled one. It's definitely, he had a complete movie. He just didn't want to stop, in my opinion. And watching the documentary, which we'll talk about a little bit more, I felt that it was very much a case of perfectionism just getting in the way of doing something, you know? Mm-hmm. I feel for me, the story overall didn't change much from between the original idea and then to the mirror, what was released ultimately. I think, you know, it definitely unfortunately kind of like with which is also a movie, a classic movie, and like is well deserving of its accolades as well, is I think definitely the release of Aladdin, which is kind of falls on fault to him for taking too long as well, and especially talking about the project as for such a long time. If you want to, like, you don't give any it for all future people who want to like make a movie and stuff like that, and you know it's going to take a lot of time, don't give away much, you know.
Well, I will your story, I will say real fast that two of the guys who worked on this movie were the character designers of Jafar. So it wasn't just that he was talking about it.
They probably wanted their character to be seen. Well, this movie's never going to be seen.
I'm not like throwing shade on them. I'm just saying that, you know, these animators, you know, obviously so many people over the decades went through this movie. So many people were students essentially of Richard Williams, that they took that and Aladdin, which is a favorite of mine, obviously it's a masterpiece, but Aladdin, you can see, is very, very influenced by this film.
Yeah. I mean, it's Aladdin and this movie as well are very influenced by the cultural Arabian 100 Nights, Arabian Nights story.
Yeah,
as
you can,
well.
You like can trace it back to the first animated movie ever, Prince Ahmed. So
But yeah, I mean, I very much believe rewatching the Miramax version and then watching the recobbled version, I feel like with the combined efforts of both movies, there could have been a very complete movie. Both sides kind of have their shortcomings. Some additions to the Miramax I actually enjoy a lot over the recobbled version. I don't get the animation is brilliant, like for sure. But I for the recobbled version, and this is mentioned in the documentary as well.
We should say as the name of the documentary, if anybody's wondering.
Yeah, but it's also I would see as also being shown by his involvement in Roger Rabbit. I'll get to that, but as he was an incredible animator, very awesome shots, which do carry on, not as length as in the Miramax version, but incredible shots still. Like when I watched this as a kid, it's like I think I watched this like at 5 years old, and it was remarkable. Like it's very vibrant of images and stuff like that. Animation incredible, but I would say that the recobble version and this, and like I said, this is something that was mentioned in the documentary. The story wasn't strong, I would say. It was a very simple story, not much added. And there are elements in the Miramax version that I think actually add to the story, specifically with it being like an Arabian Night kind of story. I did like that kind of added element of the over, essentially tack telling the story, and that felt very much like involved of like an Arabian, like this is a Arabian Night story that's being told to you. So I really enjoyed that. I do think that the tack speaking on camera, you could say, should have been saved for the end, like how the original was, which that original voice actor, very daunting, like deep voice, a deep voice would not come out of Tack's mouth.
Well,
like,
that was Matthew Broderick does kind of fit. It was supposed to be Sean Connery to record that line, but he just never showed up.
Connery wouldn't have worked either.
That was the joke, though. It was supposed to be like, oh, this little guy has this deep voice. That was the kind of gag.
That's a stupid gag.
You want to talk about stupid gags? Look at the Miramax version. That is all full of stupid gags, I'm just saying.
Well, I really do enjoy, I enjoyed and continue to enjoy it. I know like people are like, oh, the thief shouldn't have talked. I like the inner thoughts of the thief in the Miramax version. I always have. Kinda sounded like Jeff Goldblum, but it was actually John Winters, who is of another Aladdin connection of Mork and Mindy fame, and also a really great comedic actor on his own right. But I enjoyed that. And so, yeah, I think if the combined minds of what was turned in and what was like created, you know, by Richard and all his work, I think that there would have been a stronger movie. I think there are shortcomings in both. But I'm not going to sit here and say that the original is like a complete masterpiece, aside from the animation. So, yeah.
No, I think you're right about that, but definitely. But Alan, what about you?
I actually had no idea what this movie was. I never heard of it. When you mentioned it, I immediately thought it was like maybe like a 60s medieval fantasy movie or something. Like, I just had no idea. Like, I thought it was going to be live action. And not until like you sent us the link to watch it. But yeah, when I started watching it, though, I felt like I recognized Tak. Like his like mime face with like having a tack in his mouth, kind of using that as a smile or a frown.
I love
or whatever.
That, by the way. Which, when he's happening to the tack, so that was, I wrote that in my notes of how much I love that little detail. Sorry to cut you off.
No, that was actually one of my favorite details. So yeah, I guess to start off, yeah, the story is okay. Like the story is kind of just simple.
Yeah, I think clarify that up until this point, you've only seen the recobbled version, right? Correct?
Yeah, just right now. Like, this is all I've seen. I didn't see the documentary because I didn't have enough time. But I kind of read up a little bit about it during some of the slow parts. So I was kind of like reading and kind of caught up with what you guys were saying. Yeah, but essentially, I was like kind of blown away. I was actually like shocked at how fucking amazingly animated this film is. Like, I do have to say that I think maybe Richard Williams was his name.
Mm-hmm.
I think he, because from what it sounds like you guys are saying from the documentary, he got overzealous and wanted to keep going because I know this, you know, they filled in holes and they put in certain parts in the film, some sequences where there are times where I was like, yes, this could have been cut out. You didn't need it. Like, the movie didn't need to be an hour and 40 minutes, like, not at all. It could have been an hour and 15, an hour and 20 the most. But other than that, like, it was just stunning. It was gorgeous, like, super vibrant. I mean, yeah, it sucks that occasionally you would see the non-colored, not non-rendered kind of scenes, kind of show just black and white sketches and stuff, which can pull you out a little bit, but you kind of have to go in with that, like, in mind. But it was just amazing. Like, I just could not take my eyes off the screen. Like, and what's incredible is that it took 30 years to mostly make. And yeah, like, I'm not gonna lie, if it had been completed and they cut it down by like 20 minutes, I think it could have easily been one of the greatest animated films of all time. Easily better than, you know, the 90s renaissance of Disney. Like, holy shit. Like, that animation, the fluidity, everything. Like, all the characters, the way they moved, you know, Blue Meanie Jafar kind of had this, like, even, like, his capes and his, like, outfit and everything, just everything moved. Like, just, I loved it. And I kind of liked, I know we were talking in the group chat beforehand that, like, I guess the Miramax version is a little more, you know, child-friendly. This one isn't, like,
broad.
No, I'll to point that out. That's what was shocking to me. Like, I don't know what Richard Williams, like, was he intending this not to be a kid's movie? Because it would not have flied.
I don't think that, yeah, this was supposed to be, like, his, like, masterpiece of, like, showing what animation could do. It was not supposed to be a kid's movie.
Okay.
It was supposed to be like a Studio Ghibli kind of animation movie, you know, like a Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, but Studio Ghibli does not cross the line of a man half asleep fondling and pleasuring a woman in a tent. Was one thing that I was like, what the fuck?
I felt like, yeah, I felt like they kind of set it up.
That
to
was
be
the
like,
only
hey,
part.
Yeah.
No, I think he was supposed to be like an old creeper, you know, like the he's not supposed to be a good character, the king, and it's neither a Zigzag, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like, I was kind of like, okay, if anything, I would have much preferred it to be the way it was. Like, I wouldn't want it to be, like, toned down for kids or anything like that, because I just, because just so much of that beginning, those first couple sequences are so psychedelic, and, like, I won't lie, I was a little high when I started watching it, or I was coming down, and I was like, holy shit, this is, like, awesome, and, like, the checkerboard kind of spinning all over the screen, like, kind of white and black, it was awesome, like, so many amazing sequences, and like the last sequence where he kind of does that like Rube Goldberg machine, destroys all the war machines.
Yeah, but definitely Buster Keaton like influence for sure.
Oh yeah. Oh, and then like I mean, there was one scene. I mean, they I don't know if it was purposely done like that, like because a lot of the music sounded very generic. It just sounded like they took classical, public friendly kind of music, like they had like the night on, oh my god, what is it called?
It's Night on Bald Mountain, but it's a clear spoof of Disney's animation of Night on Bald Mountain,
which is movement. Yeah, my favorite. You know, Chernabog is one of my favorite Disney villains, so I had a great time seeing that part. And then after that, when the thief is kind of flying, it kind of looked like there was a little bit of inspiration from the Fletcher Superman. It reminded me one Fletcher animation, like Superman's fighting these generic fucking robots, but like the way they flew was very straight, just like how like they just wouldn't move, like it was very still, but it was fluid, and the way the thief was kind of flying over everybody was the same exact style. So I feel like, yeah, like Ariel said, like there's a lot of influences from a lot of other things, which I thought was super awesome. And if that's what he was trying to show, I mean, he did a great job. And one of the things I really loved was like the 3D effects, which must be insanely hard to do. And it's probably, you know, I can see why they went over budget, because there's just sequences where like they do great little CGI. Even like you can pause any scene or slow down a scene and like kind of just look at it. And every frame there's something going on, especially when all the war machines were being destroyed. Just so much shit was going
on. Real fast, like, Alan, that's not CGI. That shit is all hand drawn. That would be CGI today.
Yeah,
like that would be like, there's so much stuff like that today, and I think that people might not realize how impressive it is, because you will see stuff like that and it will be digitally created or digitally rendered or digitally repeated or whatever. They had to hand draw that all on cells, which is, it's mind boggling that they were able to do that. I'm sorry, keep going.
No, yeah, it's a painstakingly hard to do, like, and the thing is they did it with such fluidity where I was just like yeah, there's no way you could have done this. Like, I mean, they couldn't have done it in that time span with like CGI, obviously, but like even now, like some CGI effects don't even look as good. Just, I'm a big hand-drawn guy, like I prefer hand-drawn animation much more, you know. I don't, get me wrong, CGI animation's cool too. It's just there's something about hand-drawn that just hits better. It's kind of, you know, it's weird to say because I'm a big, you know, I love playing video games, but there's just something about like hand-drawn, like Cuphead the video game, it's still absolutely gorgeous to watch because like they did everything hand-drawn, and they did it the way they could, that they did, you know, animators did in like the golden age of Walt Disney animation, like in the 40s 50s. And that game, like, I know they made spinoffs for like Netflix or whatever cartoons, and they look like shit compared to the game because they painstakingly like went out of the way. I mean, I don't know how, maybe they did, they use like a weird CG flash animation for the shows, but like to tie it back to this, it just shows how crisp and how just, it's just so artisan. Like, that's the only thing I can say. It's just so good. I mean, again, no offense to CGI artists or anything. It's just, oh man, it's just so gorgeous to look at. Like, it's, yeah, like I said, I think my only thing is if it was finished and cut down by 20 minutes, easily a masterpiece. Easily.
Yeah, no, and I think you guys are both right about all of that. Like, Ariel, you were saying that, you know, I don't think the story doesn't really change that much. The story is pretty simple in either version, and there's talks about, like, Richard Williams had kind of talked about, like, oh, like, I want to, you know, it's going to unravel, like, this great detective story at the end, and that was clearly never going to happen. But for me, that's not really what the difference is. And I'm not trying to say like the mirror, like the version that we saw as kids was useless, because I remember like really like digging this movie too when I was a kid. Like it was always this kind of like weird movie that I would see every once in a while pop up. You know, I remember being like a kid at a wedding and like all the kids were watching this movie, and me and my friend, even when we were in high school, me and my friend John would just be like, "The Golden Balls." We would always do like that impression.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a weekly watch for me.
Yeah.
For like about a year. Yeah.
But you know, later on, I kind of found out the history of this, and just like I was saying, all the insane work that went into it. And yeah, it is something where you're like, who knows if this would ever have been finished. He seems like someone like a George R. R. Martin who's still, he's like, no, I've exactly. got it. He's keep writing, and it's just so, he keeps working and working. It's never going to be done.
So I have opinions on that, and I do feel very bad about all the animators specifically and their treatment, not just from like specifically like Richard Williams, like wasn't the greatest boss. So it's like he like fired people for trying to like
he was kind of a dick. Yeah,
but so I want to throw my kind of two cents into that of and comparing it to the experience that he, you know, it, with his involvement on Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Because yeah, that in itself was an incredible masterpiece of animation. Revolutionized that kind of art form of like essentially rediscovering a different type and developing a different type of rotoscoping, which mm-hmm. is an incredible art form to do in itself. And so, but you got to compare, they did that movie timely. They did it well. So what I believe that could have benefited the Thief and the Cobbler itself is he could have been, yeah, the origin, come up with the ideas, but have like essentially a project manager to manage him kind of thing, like have not him be the director, but have somebody else be the director, have somebody else. Okay. We got to drive this thing. We got to push things through and kind of thing. Cause he kind of got into his mind.
They almost much, did you know? That. They almost, when the Bond company took over, when he didn't, you know, cause that's what basically happened is once this movie ended up being so overdue, all studios do this, like a standard thing where it's like, okay, we've got to finish it by this time, come at this budget. Otherwise, like a Bond company will come in and like complete the movie, which is something that almost never happens, but it happened on this film. And one of the things that a pitch was made was, okay, we're going to keep these people working on it, but we're going to bring in Terry Gilliam to kind of oversee it finish it.
Yeah. Who would have fit? Because while I'm watching this movie, I'm like, this is like Terry Gilliam, like Monty Python moments.
They would have done it, and it would have been great. He would have got them to like, it's just like, it reminds me a lot of the ILM documentary on Disney Plus, where they were just kind of like way behind schedule, and just, they were doing all these groundbreaking things, but they were taking forever. And then they got on a tight schedule. They got, George Lucas came in and was like, you got to finish this up. It was basically like kind of like, kind of shitty to John Dykstra, but like whatever. And they did get it completed, and it was amazing. And if Terry Gilliam could have done that with this film, it would have been this fucking epic masterpiece, like Alan was saying. But the Bond company rejected that pitch and was just like, no, we're just going to farm it out to like studios in Hong Kong. Like one scene in studio from Hong Kong. We're going to get some Don Bluthfield to work on this. We're going to do it. And it came out how it was. So yeah, there is an alternate history that could have happened with that.
But I think Richard or somebody on his team should have recognized this like years ago, you know, like how many years does it have to take you? Especially, I think his downfall was signing the deal with Warner Brothers. I know that it was money needed and stuff like that, but you can't, you know, at the end of the day, you have to create a product, and that product needs to come out. And if you want it to be a passion project, then keep it a passion project. But if you want it to and have it accept that it's going to take decades, you know, to do. But if you want this,
he said he should have gone instead of to Warner Brothers to like studios in like Europe and stuff like that. That would have been a little more lenient and let him kind of like take his time to finish it, because that was his vision. But I just want to kind of get back into what I was saying there, that Alan, everything you were saying is absolutely right. This, the level of just competence and just how amazing this film looks. I don't think people will truly understand because, like I said, this film is all done on cells. And the way that the camera moves in this film is unlike anything animated on, like, cells ever made. Like, the way that the camera is, like, when it's zooming through the mountain, stuff like that. You will see a shot like that today. It'll be, even if it's like a hand-drawn movie, they'll still do that digitally. Like, the fact that they will do that, and that, it makes sense they took years and years and years, because there are some things in this movie that blow your mind. You're like, literally, how did they do this? Like, how many people, how many years did it take to do this shot? Like, the beginning, when they are running through all those, like you said, Rube Goldberg's and those optical illusions, and like there's the one where it's like the tiles and they fall, and it's just like one. It's literally this is like a piece of art more than it is a movie to me. It is just like this kind of moving masterpiece of just this is this style of artwork that we have seen utilized in this way that you don't really ever see, and I think the only place that gets close is Studio Ghibli, but even Miyazaki has done digital stuff like that, and he, you know, credit to him because he does get his movies actually finished, even though he does also take years and years and years to do his movies, and they always kind of fall behind and stuff like that. But God, this movie looks so incredible, and the fact that I just want to point this out, this is also animated on once. And for if anybody's listening who doesn't know what that means, a lot of film is animated on twos, which means that every two frames you'll see a new drawing. Ghibli films are animated on twos, twos or threes. And the half of this film that was animated after Richard Williams left is animated on twos. This film is all animated on ones. That means that every single frame is a new drawing. And that is part of why it is so astounding. The level of these pieces look so good. But yeah, like you said, Ariel, I don't know if this would ever be completed. It's for me, it's more of like a visual, just artwork, just almost in the way that like something like, I don't know, like I like it. I would think this is much better film than like Avatar, but like the same way that like Avatar 2 is just kind of like looking at this amazing technology, this world, this that took years and years and years to complete. But yeah, it really, going back and watching it now, because I've seen bits and pieces of the recobbled cut. I've seen like the trailer, and I've watched some of the scenes that were taken out. Like, because you can tell kind of watching the theatrical version that there are some pieces that are missing. Specifically, I think the biggest part is with the witch, because that kind of goes really quickly. And when you watch the recobbled cut, you can tell why, because there's a lot of just chunks of that are just storyboard. But the big one, I think, is the finale, which was that where the whole thing is just being destroyed, and you're seeing the thief going through everything. I also really like, for me, I appreciate what Richard or what John Winters was doing, because they clearly were like, okay, like we're gonna do, like, just like you said, Ariel, there's that Aladdin connection where it's like there's this really funny comedian, we're gonna get him in to kind of tell these jokes, be kind of anachronistic, like say things like, oh, this is like Les Mis, oh, I'm gonna do it like a pilot, you know, and like that's kind of more for the kids, you know. But I do appreciate the silent film aesthetic that was in, where you had like these characters that are kind of just Buster Keaton inspired, and they're just kind of going through, because one of the things that bugged me a little bit was just the relentless narration by someone who I'm a really big fan of. What's his name? Ferris Bueller.
Matthew Broderick? Yeah.
Yeah, I love Matthew Broderick, but yeah. I've just spaced. But the narration is just so constant, and I'm just like, I get it. I know what's happening. This is this film was designed to tell you things visually. You don't need to explain everything to me, and that got a little old. I do want to say, and also the same thing with, they also added Fido. They added like the voice for Fido. I don't know if you knew this, Alan, but he just kind of like squawks and stuff like that. You know who the voice was for Fido, Alan?
Fucking, I was like, because I was looking up the you know, like I said, the one that got slow. I was looking it up, and I was like, okay, oh, okay, so Vincent Price is, you know, Blue Meanie, and then blah, 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 whoever, and then Matthew Broderick is for the edited ones, and then I see Fido, and I'm like, this is some, like, they really, like, I'm going to stop burying the lead, Donald Pleasance.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what the fuck, the randomest person to be like, you're going to play a fucking bird. I was like, Donald Pleasance, you know.
Yeah.
legendary actor known for just so much good shit. And then, you know, obviously Halloween, but like, I was like, it's kind of one of the, like, wasn't there like an episode of South Park or something where like George Clooney just played a dog and he just barked or some shit. I was like, okay, fuck it. Maybe that's the joke. Maybe in the credits they meant to be like Donald Pleasance, and like the audience are like, "Who's he playing? Oh, is he like a villain?" And it's like, "It's a bird."
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, with him, like, there's some iconic voices. Obviously, you got Vincent Price as Zigzag, which is the one voice they kept because you can't get rid of Vincent Price. Like, amazing. Like, he's just speaking in verse the entire time, and I think it's freaking great.
Is well known playing what I consider underrated villains, like with this, and then Radigan from The Great Mouse Detective, but then also Ironside from Here Comes Peter Cottontail as well. So yeah,
but like, and he's not the only, because he recorded this in like the 60s and 70s. So like, Richard Williams just over the years got all these iconic people to do all the voices, and you lost a lot of them except for Price, like I mentioned. You lost, obviously, original Princess Yum Yum. Original King Nod was Anthony Quayle from Lawrence of Arabia. In fact, this film was in production so long that a good chunk of, there's like 10 people in this movie that this, including Vincent Price, were this, and Quayle, where this was their last film because it was in production so long that they recorded this 20 years before it came out. And then the film was eventually released with these old, well, actually, you know, some of them didn't even appear on it, but this, all these old tracks were kind of came out, and they just had them, you know, in files. Before I do wrap up of what I've been saying, I do want to say something nice about the Miramax version, which is I didn't love all of the songs. In fact, I kind of snoozed a little bit on the Princess songs because I did rewatch that just to get a little more context talking about this, but I do have a, like, it's that same, like, thing with you, Ariel, where it's like, I've got a nostalgic soft spot for that Brigand song. That song is a banger. Like, I'm not gonna lie, that just, like, boom, boom, bada, bada. Like, I kind of, like, fast-forwarded, and I made sure to stop at that song and watch the rest of the movie from there. That song's just great. Like, I love that song.
So I enjoy that one, and then I do enjoy the Princess I Want song, which, In the original, like, Aladdin was missing, like, and should have been included. Gilded Cage should have been included in the original. But I did enjoy those two because they expand on the characters that, like, in the recobbled version, you don't get much of from any of the characters. But by having those two songs, especially with the second one with the tribe, who you don't get any, not much backstory at all in the recobble version, you get more personality added to them. You know, you kind of, with that song for that outcast tribe, you kind of like,
the Brigands.
The Brigands. You're like, oh, they just like wanna, like, they just failed at one time, and like, now, like, they shouldn't be exiled, and they should, like, you know, they're good guys and stuff. So you get to care for them a lot. And yeah, like, so I do agree with you, like, that part, that song in particular, like, adds a lot to characters and stuff like that.
And it's just fun. It's just honestly super fun. Like I was not going to lie, because that was the one thing I was like, when I was re-watching the recobbled cut, I was like, oh yeah, I guess that song was added later. Oh, that's a bummer. Like, that was the one thing that I was like, oh man, I do miss that.
Mm-hmm.
I won't lie, I'm kind of glad I saw this version. I swear, I think I might have seen it, because, like I said, the cobbler, his face was so, like, it unlocked a memory, but not a complete memory. Like, I think maybe I saw it in passing as a kid.
It was,
like,
always on in the background at one of your friends' houses or something, I feel like. It was just on in, like, you would see it, like, in somewhere around, like I said, like, at that wedding I was at, just, like, for some reason, all the kids were just, like, hanging out at a wedding, and they're like, yeah, let's just throw on this one. It's just one of those, like, random weird movies from your childhood that you just, it's like, there's some core memories there, but you can't exactly unearth where they're from, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, but, no, I actually kind of prefer that I didn't hear any music in it, because I really, really like how I saw it. I mean, like, I like that it was a little bit more just animation rather than like kids animation, so I was like, oh, I dig this a lot. And especially with like all the psychedelic moments and everything, and I was just like, No, I like this ride, and I like where I'm at, so I'm really glad I saw this version. But maybe one day I'll get back. I'll get around to seeing the Miramax one, just to see the difference.
Yeah, and Miramax was kind of notorious, especially at the time, for drastically cutting movies. Like, there's this famous story of, because Miramax would cut movies, and they would also add a lot of like soundtrack and dialogue to stuff because they thought American audiences would not pay attention. And they did that with a lot of the Ghibli films when they were getting all the, like, if you can watch, like, you know, Castle in the Sky and stuff like that, and there's just, like, so much more extra stuff that's just shoved in there. And there's this really great story about when Princess Mononoke was coming out, which is my favorite animated movie. I think it is a masterpiece unlike anything I've ever seen. And when it was getting its U.S. release and Miramax was going to do it, Miyazaki's producer sent Harvey Weinstein, who was the guy who, human piece of shit, and the guy responsible for a lot of these cuts in the Ghibli films and this one and so many other things, he sent him a sword and it said, no cuts. And there was no cuts in Princess Mononoke. And Miyazaki later said, I defeated him. And I thought that was so fucking great.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, Princess Mononoke is like an absolutely amazing film. Like, it is a masterpiece. If anything, that was the movie I saw in the background where somebody was watching and I walked in on it and I was like, you can have gore and just adult themes and animation. And this is before I got into anime. This was just like, what the fuck am I watching? Like, whoa, like as a kid, you're like, oh, there shouldn't be blood or there shouldn't be gore or anything like that. Or just like mature themes and stuff. Like, I was like blown away. But again, I digress.
Yeah. Like, rewatching it, one thing I was thinking about is that the way that this film uses its film as, like, visual language, and it's just like, yeah, these are the things we can do in film with very little dialogue, and just tell a story through the aesthetics of movies. And it reminded me a lot of Mad Max Fury Road in that respect, where it is just kind of just like, here's the plot being propelled forward by these images. And because one thing I do a lot is when I edit this show, I'll be listening to it and editing on my laptop, and I will like to have something visual on in the background for me to just kind of like glance up at or something. Something that is visually very compelling, but I'll have it on mute because I don't want to be listening to it and I don't want to be distracted. I don't want any subtitles or anything. So some movies that I've done that, like with Mad Max, In the Mood for Love, and I think this is honestly, I'll probably throw this on while I'm editing this episode because the way it really does feel like a Mad Max or like a silent film where it is just propelled by these incredible visuals. And I just keep thinking of that scene where he's running, you're seeing all the spirals. It's just, even if you don't rewatch this movie, anybody who's listening, just look up those scenes. Just watch the trailer for the recobbled cut because it will blow your fucking mind.
Absolutely, I agree. And it also reminded me, I need to go back and finish it, but another visual film that just came out not too long ago is Mad God, where that one has been in production. Well, I think Phil Tippett's just been working on it on his own for like 30 years. And that one, I mean, I will say when I was watching, it was kind of slower. It's not as, you know, all over the place and really vibrant. It's a lot more darker tone, but it still has like, it's still one of those pieces where, like, even though I was kind of like sometimes a little bored, it's still gorgeous and wonderful to watch. Like, I was like just blown away about its own, like, you know, stop motion and the art that goes into that. So if you're ever feeling that same type of thing that you're like, I want to watch something that's just a visual story, there you go. You know, you got a Thief and the Cobbler, and then you got Mad God. I always appreciate films like that.
And I think that's Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that's a really apt comparison because I think Tippett, like Williams, is this guy who is just the master of his craft. And he, you know, like you said, was working on this film for so long. And then after Jurassic Park, I think he was kind of like, all right, I'm kind of done with this. I think that stop motion's kind of done. It's on the way out. But he came back to it years later. I think the pandemic was like, he was like, I'm going to go back to this and finish it. And both of these guys have been huge names in the industry, but they never had their like thing. There's never been like Richard Williams' movie. He's always been like, oh, the guy who worked on Roger Rabbit, or the guy who did the openings to Pink Panther, or the opening to, like, What's New. He would do these, all those. You don't see him anymore because it's now, like, credits now are kind of boring and they're all CG or whatever. But, like, he, when you would see these great animated openings for movies, he did so many iconic ones in the same way that Phil Tippett has worked in the industry for so long doing Jurassic Park and doing all these great, like, different anime stop motion things. Williams worked in the industry, and they're both Oscar winners. You know, they've both won Oscars for, like, shorts and stuff like that in the same way. So that, I think that's a really good comparison.
Man, I do miss animated intros. Holy shit. Like,
right?
I really miss it. Every time, like, you know, I mean, I like, all three of us, you know, I think Derek's the most prominent of us being a writer, but I think all three of us, you know, we have our ideas. We write, like, even on my phone, I have plenty of fucking story ideas that I never got around to, like, getting to it, but I usually write with, like, music playing, and, like, the first fucking thing I usually think of an idea of a film, and the first thing I think of is, like, I want to have, like, an animated title sequence, and I want it to be like this, to the point where I start kind of directing that in my head of how I want it. And truly, truly, I think, like, opening title credits, like, that art sadly is kind of dying off, or, like, now I understand that there's, like, this cinematic appeal of just getting right into the movie, and then now you have all these big blockbusters where you see certain logos and you're like, I already know what I'm in for. And then the movie starts, and then they'll show the title at the end of the movie at the end credits. I know Marvel's doing a really great job of, like, at least doing something cool with the end credits. But I really do miss, like, the animated intro credits to a film, because it, like, Scott Pilgrim versus World has one of greatest fucking intro credits sequence. Like, I saw that premiere night, and I just remember all my buddies and I, we were sitting there, and you know, fucking the Sex Bob-ombs are playing, and then it just starts going, and, like, the couch gets pulled back, and then it has, like, all the, you know, all the X's have their own little animated sequences kind of thing for the cast names. It really sets up the mood for you for a film, and goddamn, like, just sitting there, I remember just, like, going, holy shit, we're in for a great time. It's just, it's something that is really a dying art that I wish we would see more often in film.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, do you guys, before we wrap up here, did you guys have any final thoughts on Thief and the Cobbler?
Just, yeah, check it out specifically for the animation. And just, yeah, see, I really do hope, and I kind of just, it sucks from a audience point of view that, I mean, yeah, it's understandable that he felt like, oh, I'm never going to, like, animate anything again. But he did animate a few things. I watched some of them, but not to this degree. But yeah, I mean, it sucks when people are, like, clearly talented, but once they have, like, a kind of downfall, or, like, not a downfall, but, like, something gets taken away. Like, this could equate to kind of like a Walt Disney getting Oswald the Lucky Rabbit taken away from him, and he just stopped, you know, kind of thing. So it's a very sad shame that he didn't move on and continue and do something, you know, just try again.
I do have something to say about that, but because he did, and like the end of the documentary Persistence of Vision was saying, he was working on a film.
But they're shorts. They're shorts.
He was planning to do a film based on the ancient Greek play. But it was the same thing that happened with this. He just never finished it. It was planned to be a feature, but he just, you know, it's that same thing where he's such a perfectionist that he never got it done. He only got the first part, the prologue done, which eventually he did release as prologue, and it won the Academy Award for Best Short Film. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, he just wasn't able to finish it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the prologue. I watched it. It's not the same style. It's a lot more realism, sketch drawings. Mm-hmm. and it's literally 6 minutes, which is, yeah, it just kind of sucks. It's like you said, it's a very, he seemed like a very George R.R. Martin kind of person, which I don't really like that type of person. I don't like George R.R. Martin that much.
Very Kubrick-esque.
Yeah, I get it though. Yeah. It's tough to fucking write. But you're right.
It's not a. I don't know. Like, he's the type of artist that like wants. He's talented. He has talent, but it's not even about a drive. It's just about being realistic in your art, I guess you could say.
And yeah, but there's like, that.
Unfortunately, there's people. You know, there's like, and it's he's the definition of like a tragic artist, I think, for sure.
Like, there's that part in the documentary where they're talking about, like, there's that scene with the soldier, and it's such an incredible sequence where the soldier is like climbing onto the back, and he's got like 18 arrows in his back, and he's climbing on the horse. And it's supposed to be like a 15 second thing, and then it ends up being like a minute long because he was like, this is so good. He just kept going and going and going and going. And it's like, at some point, you've got to, and this is something, yeah, like you're right. Yeah. Like, me being a writer, I'm like, at some point, like, you've got to like stop and be like, I have a deadline. I need to do this. I'm going to, this is as good as, like, I know that I can make this better, but I've got to stop now and work on the next part. Otherwise, you'll never finish anything. So, yeah, yeah, it seems like he wasn't able to, unfortunately, compartmentalize that and do that, which is a shame. But the George R. R. Martin thing reminds me of something. I don't think I've told this story on the podcast before, but I think you'll appreciate this, Alan. There was this interview where George R. R. Martin was talking to Stephen King, and they were interviewing each other.
Oh, I love that scene. Yeah. I love it.
And George R. R. Martin goes, Stephen, I've got one question for you. How the fuck do you write so fast? And like that just says it all right there. Because Stephen King will put out like 8 books a year. That guy's a psychopath. You know, George R. R. Martin will like write 2 pages in 8 months.
Yeah. Yeah. No, because Stephen King's a genius in that way. Like, he just is a genius. You know?
I feel like Stephen King is the type of dude who just, he makes it his job. Like, he's like, I gotta write like 4,000 words every day. Like, he makes it like, I think he's the epitome of like, you master something at 10,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure he's clocked in way more.
Oh yeah,
than 10,000.
No, I don't know if you've ever read his book on writing. It's such a phenomenal story. I mean, book. It's such a phenomenal book. It literally helped me learn how to write correctly because of just how clear he makes things are. Like, it is very much a dive into his mind, but you get to like, oh, like you're like incredibly smart and you know the art of writing, but it's not, you're not being pretentious at all. It's just like listening to like a friend teach you something is very much how Stephen King's on writing is. It's definitely a worth watch, a worth read book.
I have it here somewhere on my bookshelf.
I have it somewhere too on my bookshelf. But yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that reminds me of a book this that I just, book. I just,
yeah, oh, very nice. Such yeah. a perfect.
Yeah, I just, speaking of that, I just, this is tangential, but I just finished the book, Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies, and it's the same kind of thing, but for films. And I really recommend anybody who is interested in filmmaking, definitely check that out. Sidney Lumet, obviously an incredible director. His first film in 1957 was 12 Angry Men. His last film in 2007 was Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. So just like a 50-year career of just like his like Network and Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon, like all in between. So yeah, like on the same vein of like just somebody who just is a master of their craft. Like, if anybody out there wants to like read a really good book on making movies, read Making Movies by Sidney Lumet.
I would recommend Stephen King's for if you're a screenwriter also, because just how thematic is his writing is, for sure.
No.
I would recommend, there's this one documentary, oh my god, I never saw the whole thing, but oh god, what is it called? It's like Filming America or something like that. It's like these two just guys who just love movies, and they document themselves making a movie, and there's sequences where it just shows the process of making a film, and they make it so fun.
American Made?
American movie. I think it's called American.
Yeah, American movie.
Oh shit! Okay. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that, but I've heard yeah, really good. They're good. Like they do it on podcasts. Like it's 1999. Elijah Wood did an episode on that. So
mm-hmm. nice. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think I heard about it from James Rolfe. He's the Angry Video Game Nerd on YouTube from Cinemassacre and stuff. And that's like one of his like most favorite films. And that guy's mm-hmm. like a massive cinephile. And like anytime, you know, one of my favorite things to watch from James Rolfe is when he just talks about film. Because, yeah, his mm-hmm. video game stuff is funny, but he knows film. And like this guy has watched probably more films than like all three of us combined times three. Mm-hmm. Like that dude's a madman, but like he brings it up all the time, and I think he even used it as influence for like one of the films that he was able to make. But I would definitely, yeah, I think it's American Movie. Unfortunately,
it's American Movie, yeah.
American Movie, yeah. I think yeah. one of the guys passed away recently too, maybe mm-hmm. like in the 1 or 2 years mm-hmm. ago. But yeah,
I mean, and that's the thing. I love movies like about movies, like documentaries about movies are always so like that's why I really dug Persistence of Vision, like about this one. It's like Abed from Community. He's like, yeah, everyone knows that Hearts of Darkness is better than Apocalypse Now. And like that seems like a joke, but it's true. Like Hearts of Darkness is fucking incredible.
No, I'm a big fan of that too.
Yeah, yeah. Any final thoughts here, guys, before we wrap it up?
I guess like what is like your guys' go-to animated film? That's the only thing I guess I can ask. Like that you feel is almost on par with like the direction of it and like the styling, like how much of the craft goes into it where you go, yeah, this was like all the love was in it.
Yeah. My favorite is Lilo and Stitch, but a movie that I literally like it was just because it hit at that time and we just watched it almost every day in band class at the end of the year 1 year in junior high, and I think I never got tired of it. I still never get tired of it. I could rewatch it over and over again is The Incredibles. It's such a masterpiece of a movie, and yeah, like you could I watched it I think for a solid month back to back to back. We started it from the beginning each day, so we like essentially like ended at the same point, and we never complained, we never got tired of it. It was always like, yes, like this I remember when that movie came out and it was just like, this is the epitome of like cartoons, like this is mm-hmm. such an incredible movie, not pun unintended, but yeah, like so The Incredibles is one for sure. And then from then it's like just like being in the mood for a movie of like holiday movies, usually like yeah, like a here like I mentioned with another Vincent Price one, Here Comes Peter Cottontail is always a fun one. And yeah, but I think The Incredibles is going to be the one that I could like pop in and just watch. I know at one point I think I could trigger it back into it. But at one point I could word for word recite that movie. And I think I could still like it might take like kick in at the 10-minute mark, but I think I could recite that whole movie.
That movie is a fucking masterpiece. Mm-hmm. That's probably my favorite Pixar movie, which is saying a lot because I goddamn love Pixar and Toy Story 3 exists. But yeah, for me, I think of the Disney movies, like Mulan is flawless. That movie is so goddamn good. And it's
speaking, you were speaking about like a shot of the mountains, and I was going to say like, I think Mulan is the one that comes like closest to that. Like,
yeah, just Mulan, that shot. Mulan does some really mm-hmm. They do some digital stuff in that, but it does look seamless. Like, it looks incredible. I love the way too. Like a lot of the movies, you know, a lot of the Disney Renaissance movies owe their heritage to this movie in that this tried to emulate that Arabian style. A lot of the great movies in the Disney Renaissance emulated these styles of where they were set. Obviously, Hercules was supposed to kind of look like the art on pots and stuff like that, and Mulan does a really good job of emulating the art of ancient China, and it's also just like a flawless movie. Like, it's so good. The character arc that she goes on is so incredible, just of self-realization and everything. Coraline, fucking banger. Coraline, so good. Technical Marvel and Neil Gaiman just adaptation, But I mean, it's gonna be the same one. If I'm giving you my real answer, it's the same one that I brought up like five times. It's Princess Mononoke. That movie fundamentally just has changed me as a person. It rewired my brain. That movie, more than anything, has had an effect on me as like a writer, like in the way that I want to tell stories, in the way that I see the world. It's one of those movies that I can vividly remember watching it for the first time. It was for my old roommate, one of my best friends in high school. Like he was in the Japanese club and he's like, you got to watch this movie. And we watched it on the big screen up at the campus. And I was like blown away. I was like, nothing will ever be the same after watching this movie. It's a movie that I still watch two or three times a year. They're doing it. Shout out to our friends over at the Frida, our local independent cinema we've got here. They're going to be doing the Ghibli Fest. I'm going to be seeing it at least once up on the big screen. I always do love to go see that movie when it's playing theatrically. It's perfect. Subbed and dubbed, I'll watch it anytime, day or night. I love Princess Mononoke. It lives in my heart.
Hell yeah. Well, for me, it's not a movie I rewatch frequently because I just like, because it is a very, as my girlfriend had mentioned it, she's like, oh, that's a movie. And we had talked about it before. It's actually on, I think we did it on You've Never Seen. So go check that out if you want to hear us talk about it. Is Akira.
Yeah.
It's just fucking just so well animated.
Animated on ones, Akira. Shout out.
See, there we go. I fucking knew it. I knew it.
But how long did it take?
God, yeah. they got through it, man. They got through it pretty quick. But yeah, man, that film just...
They had a manga to trace over to.
That's true, yeah. They really, and I mean, the writer and artist of the manga, I think he directed the film as well. So he kind of... They had a lot of
help. A direction already, yeah.
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 But yeah, no, it's just gorgeous, just stunning. I that's a movie I kind of want to save to watch from the big screen because I've never had a chance to do it. And just, yeah, hopefully, you know, our friends out at Frida do it too. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening. As we said, we are the Undercast company here at Underrated. And yeah, we do some other shows as well. If anyone wants to check out our other shows, Ariel also has the aforementioned You've Never Seen, which comes out on the first of every month, where she will take us into the world of a movie that we should have seen by this point, or sometimes we will introduce her to a movie that she should have seen, a cinematic classic or just a piece of pop culture, but something we can then, after we've seen it, say, now we've seen it. There's also a couple other podcasts that I do. I every day that this comes out, I am also on I'm a co-host on my friend Damien's show, Can I Say Something, which kind of is just kind of general what we've been watching type show. And then there's also Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, which is whenever there is a new MCU property that comes out, movie or show, I get together and grab some people. Usually it's you guys, or it can be any number of people, and talk about the property, and that's a lot of fun. And then, like I mentioned at the beginning of this show, this was a listener suggestion. We are going to be trying to do that more. One way we are going to be doing that is that we have a Patreon, and we just added a new tier where if you are a $5 patron, it's only $5 for our highest tier, also very affordable, you can, after 6 months, you can tell us a movie, and we will do that movie. We will cover it. So if you do really have a movie that you want to suggest to us, you can always suggest it and we might do it. But if you want to guarantee that we'll talk about it, sign up for our Patreon and we will talk about it.
We'll do it as our next one, like after you hit the 6 months. We'll
exactly.
Do it
yep. So, really looking forward to that. We do have somebody who has signed up already, so they are an official producer now. So thank you. And so hopefully we'll be getting some more of those in the past. We have a lot of great patrons over there. So hopefully we get to see some more of you guys and talk about some films. Really looking forward to doing some more episode suggestions from both the patrons and just ones that we get that we want to pick. We've got some really cool episodes of this show coming out. Next week we're going to be talking to one of my favorite podcasters, Billy Ray Bruton, agreed to come on, and we got to talk about A Home at the End of the World, which is already recorded and I still need to edit. So look forward to that, and look forward to all the other stuff that we got coming down the pike.
Symbol, thank you so much, you guys. And thank you for the suggestion. We really, really appreciate it. Can't wait to hear from you guys again. And yeah, that's us signing off. Take it easy, everybody.
Bye. Thanks for being amazing.
See ya.